listening to the Tennis.com podcast. And here's your host, Ed McGrogan.
Hello, friends. As always, this is Ed McGrogan and Steve Tignor here on the Tennis.com podcast. Steve, Friday before the WTA finals begins, there's still a lot also, you know, that's happened this week in the tennis world off the court. Obviously, there is the lingering Nick Kyrgios story, which certainly took on a life beyond the tennis sphere that we usually see stories contained in. There's also some, you know, early in the week you had Serena Williams calling it a season. You had, and then a couple days later, Rafael Nadal as well announcing that he would be done with his year. There's really a lot to tackle. I guess I'll just kind of let you go where you want to with it. What have you thought about kind of these stories thus far?
Well, I guess, yeah, in the past few years, there hasn't been as many of these stories of the idea of the season being too long. And you know, I felt like we were past that a little bit, that players still kept playing through the fall. And there wasn't as much controversy about the season's length. But this year, it seems like we've gone back to you'd almost wish the whole thing had ended after the U.S. Open. You know, obviously, Roger Federer has been out. Now, Rafael Nadal is going to be out. Serena Williams isn't going to play the WTA Finals. Sounds like Djokovic would like to be out. He's sort of, you know, limping to the finish line or lost some motivation. Even Nick Kyrgios, now he'll be suspended until next year. That really isn't a huge deal. I think he missed just a couple tournaments. But it does seem like there's a sense of, again, as there used to be, a sort of, almost let's get it over with kind of feel to the end of the season, which is, you know, it's obviously unfortunate.
Yeah, I mean, I've always maintained that I'd love to see the season end at the U.S. Open. It's not, I don't foresee it ever happening for many, many reasons. But let me, you know, one thing I did get thinking about amongst all this talk, and let me float this to you, and I believe you may tell me that this has happened before in tennis history, that one thing I would love to see and considered is if the tours ever wanted to, you know, with the WTA Finals, the ATP World Tour Finals, you know, to me, I would think it would be great if those actually kicked off a season instead of ended a season where you're limping towards these tournaments. There's obviously some major, major withdrawals on both sides. And if you did that, you'd really give the season sort of that opening day feel that I think it lacks with tournaments spread around the world, you know, somewhat minor events in relative standing to the others. You know, you would have the focus on the tours. I know we're kind of getting a little off path here, but it's one thing that I think about now that is, you know, I think a lost opportunity and perhaps really a good solution to where we are.
Yeah. I think the Hopman Cup has tried to bring that feel. It's a dual gender team event, a national team event that puts everybody together and sort of gets the season started in January. It's an exhibition and just a small tournament at the moment in Australia, but it does sort of have a good kickoff feel to it. You do feel like there would be a way to sort of get everybody together to start the year. You know, I agree that's a good idea. I mean, if you could finish the year with the two tournaments together, it would add so much. I feel like both, you know, you have the slams being dual gender, you know, brings everybody, you know, gets everybody involved, and there's sort of a, you know, it's a tennis sort of celebration, those four tournaments. But then you get to the thing that holds back these tour finals, I feel, is they, you know, you go to dual gender, they, you know, that it does feel like there's always going to be something lacking that does, you know, it can't rise to the level of a slam because it's just, it's a group of players who we've seen together and been playing together all year. There's no, you know, it they definitely lack something. You can feel that in Singapore. And even, you know, as good as London is, it's still just eight guys. It's still just, it does feel like it comes a little, you know, it's a little bit of an afterthought.
Which of these tournaments, in your estimation, given what we've seen on both tours with, as I mentioned, Serena, Rafa, Federer, you know, Djokovic kind of really laboring at the moment? I mean, what one of these is really suffering the most in your mind from this lack of star power?
Well, I guess you'd have to say Paris coming up. You have no Federer, no Nadal, and Paris and London, really. I mean, that's what that tournament, that's what the ATP Finals is about. The biggest names, if you take out Federer and Rafa out of the top eight, you know, that puts a damper on that. And the fact that Djokovic, and I think, you know, Andy Murray is kind of saving the day with his attempt to get to number one. He's the one guy who seems to be thriving right now and really wants to be out there. But yeah, I think Paris will obviously suffer. London, I guess it will depend on whether on the Murray Djokovic showdown in London, whether that can sort of override the Federer and Rafa not being there.
You'd have to think that if the numbers check out and if Murray has a chance to actually win the year-end number one ranking in London, no less, that would be, you know, an amazing story in its own right too, and that's, you know, something to keep an eye on. We're getting a little beyond. This is a few weeks away, but let's move to the WTA Finals, which start on Sunday. Actually, draws were made today. We actually only truthfully know seven of the eight competitors. It depends on Svetlana Kuznetsova's play in Moscow, which is actually going on, you know, as we record this here. She has to win the title to make the field of eight. The rest of the tournament, the draw was made this morning in Singapore, and world number one Angelique Kerber gets paired with Halep and Madison Keys and Dominika Sabalenka also. I mean, you know, Serena's withdrawal notwithstanding, I do think this is another great, it's another great opportunity, I think, for Kerber to just, you know, really cap this year as a beginning to end display of really, you know, a year that is probably clearly going to be the best of that she's ever going to put forth. But I think this tournament has got to have a lot of significance for her, given all the questions she's answered this year and really the run she's been on since January through almost all different surfaces and all different parts of the world.
Yeah, I think, you know, obviously this has been a career year. She's done it at big events, but now it's different. Not only is she number one, but Serena's not there. So this is the first time when you feel like she'll kind of be carrying the tour. She'll be the face of the tour. And that's something something she'll have to think about and we'll have to think about in the future. She's never done much at the WTA Finals. She's been there the last few years, but I think her record is 2-7, against the best players. So in that way, it's another sort of challenge. She, you know, she hadn't started out this year having ever done all that much at the Slams, and now she has two. But and so this is another sort of test for her, I guess, and maybe the first time she'll feel like that sense of being sort of the player to beat at a big event. So in that way, it'll be interesting to see whether she can, you know, mentally stand up to that, and whether her game is something that works in that sense, where she, you know, does she have the type of game that she can just take over a match? You know, that's never been her style, and that's usually the style of a number one player. So we'll see how she does against, you know, she's in a good group. Simona Halep, who's had a good season as well. Madison Keys hasn't done much against Kerber, but she can obviously beat anybody. And Sabalenka has also had a quietly had a really good year. You know, has won three tournaments herself. So that's a tough foursome.
Yeah, and I mean, I think about the round robin nature of this event as well, where you can where you can afford a loss and still move on. I think about think about players who that may benefit. You know, sort of games that can be explosive, but on the wrong day can kind of go south. I do think of Madison Keys in that regard. Maybe this is, and this will be the first time she's in this this final season ending championship of the year. I think for that reason, I think of her and kind of consider her chances a little differently given that format. You know, overall, the rest of the field, I mean, who else does this event strike you as maybe maybe more important than others, given either the way that their year has transpired or really that this is just maybe the opportunity of their career to this point?
Well, I think somebody like Muguruza, she had a good tournament here last year. She was on a good run in the fall. This year, obviously, not the case. She has, I would say, been in a slump pretty much since winning the French Open. Well, how does she finish out the year? How does she go into next year? You know, where does she put herself? Last year, she put herself near the top going into 2016. She kind of consolidated that by winning the French Open, but now, you know, what will we think of her going into 2017, and how would she feel about it? I think this is an event, you know, really her prospects don't look that good judging by her recent record, her form, but you have to feel like she can turn it around, and maybe this is an event where that can happen. I think Sibulkova, she's never played in this tournament before. She's had a really good year. I don't know if anybody really even expected to see her there. She hasn't been in the top 10 for most of this season. You know, she'll be an interesting player to watch. She's played well against Kerber. You know, she even though this is her first time in this tournament, she's an experienced player, and I think she can stand up to those, you know, Kerber and Halep pretty well.
Yeah, and the only players we haven't mentioned at this point, Radwanska and Pliskova, they'll be with Muguruza in her group. You know, I think also another good opportunity for Pliskova to, became really, I think, a name for the first time to many, many fans at the U.S. Open, and we'll get another chance to watch her against, obviously, top-tier competition. Radwanska, meanwhile, we've seen for what seems like the better part of a decade now in spots like this. Former WTA Finals champion, I believe, if memory serves. So, you know, always obviously someone that shouldn't be overlooked in a format like this, too. You know, let's quickly, I do want to get kind of your thoughts on Kyrgios as well, if you've kind of said everything about the WTA Finals there, because Kyrgios, I thought, just divided opinion so sharply within tennis circles, and outside of tennis circles, he just generated opinion, which I think is hard to do in both situations. I think a lot of people saw the ATP's punishment, the 8-week ban, which could be brought down to 3, potentially, given if Kyrgios decides to go forth with the tour's recommendations, insistence on really seeking psychological help, it seems. You know, some, I think, really found, at first glance, I have to say, I was, given the history of the tour's involvement in spots like this, and some of the situations where they really haven't interjected in and you know, either suspended players or put down fines, or really just put down fines, I was quite honestly surprised at how much the ATP suspended him for. I do wonder if this is kind of this is a stance Chris Kermode from the ATP wanted to really just get out in front of. And I think, you know, given Kyrgios' history obviously doesn't help his cause whatsoever with this. Quite honestly, I thought, you know, in addition to this, that his decision to bail on Rotterdam next year to play a basketball exhibition was, you know, also kind of really laughable too at this point. But, you know, I just, you know, seeing Kyrgios being in really the greater public eye for the better part of 2 weeks now, I mean, what are your thoughts on really the whole situation that he's in after really quite a, you know, honestly, actually a career year for him too?
Yeah, I was, you know, I guess I shouldn't have been surprised. I was a little surprised after he did so well in Tokyo that he would suddenly just tank a match in Shanghai. You really shouldn't be surprised by that. But there had been a sense the week before when he won the tournament in Tokyo and was talking about his physical training, how he was taking it seriously for the first time this season, that there was some turnaround, but obviously not. I guess with Kyrgios, you know, the punishment was strong. I think they want to send a message to him for the future. They could probably see this kind of thing happening with him over and over. And I think they, I think where he went a step beyond was not just tanking, but then talking about the fans, how he didn't care what, you know, he really had no regard for the fact that fans had paid money to see him. He basically blatantly said he didn't care about that. And I think that's, you know, that's the bad side, the downside of somebody like Kyrgios. What do you do with somebody like that? They, you know, they talk about having him seek psychological help. I mean, can somebody help him enjoy his job? Can somebody help him enjoy playing tennis? Can somebody help him want to compete week to week, you know, week after week, and enjoy the grind? I don't know if that's a, I don't know if that's something you can convince somebody of, who doesn't really, who has obviously said he doesn't really even like what he's doing that much. When I wrote about his, that incident, I started to write some, you know, a sort of typical line that you can't have players not trying or insulting fans, because there would be no tour if that was, obviously there would be no tour if that was what everybody did. But then I thought again, you know, Kyrgios, I don't, would Kyrgios even care if there was no tour? Like, there's hard, it's hard to say what punishment would work against somebody who is upfront about the fact that they're, that they don't love being a tennis pro. Or, you know, and I think it's sort of a matter if he doesn't love competing week to week. It's, you know, even when he's playing well or winning matches, sometimes he's up and down in matches. You know, he, you know, I don't know what exactly it is that he doesn't love about tennis. Is it tennis itself, or is it just what would he like, you know? And then how do you discipline somebody like that? That's, I think that's the question.
Yeah, it's one that a lot of, that I think is still being really discussed and all. And I, you know, I am quite curious to see really what, you know, he'll be coming back right at the heart of the Australian season, at the Australian Open most likely, which I think is quite interesting. You know, he'll be at the tournament where the spotlight would have been on him most greatly anyway, and really that tennis will get its first time back in the limelight as well here. So to see the immediate response, which, you know, you could, I could easily picture it as the, you know, you could see the, you could kind of read the articles already thinking about the return, the contrite Kyrgios taking, you know, taking stock of his situation. But, you know, even after that, it's going to be a time where you're going to have to take the long view of Nick Kyrgios, whether, you know, anything he does in January is not representative of what he's going to be doing in September or October, as we've clearly seen already here. So, you know, even I don't think answers really come easily, even when this all shakes out by the end of this suspension. And like you said, it's not as if he seems even really willing to kind of, you know, care about what those answers are.
And also, I think he does. It's not like his career or his season has suffered, even though he's had a couple times where he said he didn't want to be out there, or he hadn't really been training that much. He said that at, you know, or hadn't really been into it at, said that at Wimbledon. But yet he was almost in the top 10. He won three tournaments. I'm sure he's won, you know, $5 million. It's almost as if the game comes a little too easily for him. He's, you know, he always has that serve. He's always got that athleticism, or what, you know, no matter what he does. Even if he has ups and downs mentally, he can always get himself out of it during matches, and he seems to be able to win and continue to improve or improve his ranking even while he's talking about how much he's not enjoying himself. So he's, I think you have to wonder whether, do you think Kyrgios is going to change over the next 10 years? Is he going to be, you know, you might chalk this up to just a youthful, you know, a phase. You know, if I had to guess, I don't feel like he's shown any signs that he's going to feel differently about tennis in 5 years, if he's even on the tour. You know, I don't know whether, you know, I guess that's the other issue, is he somebody who can change, or who will want to?
Yeah, no, that's fair. I mean, as I said, career season. You know, certainly it's worked to this point for him in some way. You can't deny that. So, with that said, we will end this podcast. Return as the WTA finals move along next week. A lot of video coverage, by the way, of the WTA finals from Singapore on tennis.com. You also want to check out Tiebreak 10s. It's an exhibition that is taking place on Sunday in Vienna to go along with really tennis's efforts, as you've discussed before in the magazine, to really speed up the game. This is a format that is pitting six players, including Andy Murray, Tsonga, Dominic Thiem, over 10-point tiebreak matches, really a tournament that resolves itself in about 2 hours. So we'll have video of that stream live and replayed on tennis.com all throughout next week, and it's live on Sunday, 1 p.m. Eastern. So plenty going on in the tennis world on the site and all around. So please return, check it out, and we'll be back next week for the tennis.com podcast. Thank you again for listening. This is Ed McGrogan for Steve Taylor.
You've been enjoying the tennis.com podcast. For all the latest news and events, head over to tennis.com.